tax benefits for you and lasting value for KPFK. It's easy to start. Just visit kpfk.org/real estate or call 1-844-277-4663 and learn how your gift of property can make a meaningful difference.
This is April Grace, and you and I are listening to KPFK, 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, 93.7 FM in San Diego, and 99.5 FM in Ridgecrest and China Lake. Also streaming online at kpfk.org.
Welcome to Rising Up with Sonali, an independently produced subscriber-supported program syndicated to radio stations, free speech, TV, and podcast platforms. On this show, you'll hear solutions journalism for social justice, fueling action, not despair. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, host and executive producer. This week, we'll begin the show with a look at a fascinating story of how a small New England town won divestment from Israel. Journalist Tamar Sarai joins me to discuss how the town of Somerville, Massachusetts, became the first in the nation to pass a ballot measure instructing local authorities to divest from the state of Israel and how other towns can follow suit. Then we'll spend the rest of the hour with Chanel Matthews and Marjana Zhukovska, co-editors of the new anthology Liberation Stories, Building Narrative Power for 21st Century Social Movements. The book aims to help progressive, people-centered narratives take hold, stories that can reshape our world to center collective care and equity. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, host and executive producer of Rising Up with Sonali, an independently produced, subscriber-supported program nationally syndicated to radio stations, free speech TV, and podcast platforms. Our interviews are available to subscribers at risingupwithsonali.com. On November 4th, 2025, the small New England town of Somerville, Massachusetts, became the first in the nation to pass a ballot measure instructing local authorities to divest from Israel. The vote, labeled Question 3, passed with 56% support. And weeks later, the Somerville City Council followed through with the voter demand and passed a resolution to follow through on the process of divestment. How did Somerville do it, and how can other cities follow suit? Joining me to tell us all about it is journalist Tamar Sarai. She's based in Philadelphia and is currently a contributing writer at Prism and also a history PhD student at Temple University. And she wrote a story for Prism about the Somerville vote. Welcome to the program, Tamar.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So let's talk about Somerville's small little town, but very liberal. And although it sounds like something that might be seen as, oh, well, it's not terribly surprising, as you point out in your story on Prism, the issue of Question 3 was not without challenges. How did it start? I understand it was just 2 short years ago that a single individual was able to begin mobilizing and helped form a broad-based coalition to make this question and ballot measure possible.
Yes. So the organization behind the ballot question is called Somerville for Palestine. And it's a group of local organizers, community members that came together at the end of 2023. And they're really committed to having their city council pass a ceasefire resolution. And so they successfully advocated for that ceasefire resolution, and it passed in January of 2024, making Somerville actually the first city in Massachusetts to pass their own ceasefire resolution. So that was a big win for Somerville for Palestine, especially given the fact that the coalition was so new. And from there, they really wanted to make sure that Somerville was a part of the BDS movement, so boycott, divest, sanction. And that started with organizers just following the money and doing a lot of in-depth research. The organizers that I spoke to for the story mentioned filing numerous FOIA requests just to understand where Somerville taxpayer funds were going and whether any of those companies were also on the BDS list. And so that research revealed a number of companies that were implicated in Israel's genocide. They found that $1.7 million in contracts were going to Hewlett-Packard over the past 10 years, as well as about $500,000 to Lockheed Martin, a weapons manufacturer. So when they have this information, Somerville for Palestine organizers immediately thought that they would just go to the city council and have them pass a divestment ordinance. They were really confident this would go well and go pretty smoothly because of the January 2024 ceasefire resolution. But they met a lot of resistance, and they weren't able to get the city council to pass their own divestment ordinance. And so that's when the ballot question kind of came into play, and they crafted question three in order to have Somerville voters kind of express their desire for a divestment ordinance.
And right. And I imagine that it has so much to do with the fact that historically there's been so much political risk associated with in any way going against the state of Israel, because it has been equated to anti-Semitism. And this equation, thankfully, now seems to be breaking down. And so it seems as though the ballot measure was a way to say, look, we're going to give you cover because we're going to show that it's popular with the voters. And therefore, if voters instruct you to do this, then, you know, you as lawmakers can avoid these baseless accusations. Is that fair to say?
Exactly. That's exactly right. And I think, as you mentioned, 56% of Somerville voters were in support of this ballot measure. And the ballot question actually earned more votes than any single elected official who was on the ballot in November 4th. So there's definitely a lot of a groundswell of support from mm-hmm. the people.
And then the Anti-Defamation League stepped in to try to stop this. I mean, this is an organization that you would think would have better things to do than interfere in the election of a very small town in New England. But it has been a stalwart supporter of Israel's war crimes for a very long time. What did the ADL do in Somerville? They spent lots of money, I understand.
Yeah, over $200,000 went towards Somerville United Against Discrimination, which is an ADL-funded local Somerville organization that was, its express purpose was opposing the ballot question. They filed two lawsuits against the city of Somerville. They repeatedly disputed the signatures that Somerville for Palestine organizers collected in order to get the question on the ballot. And in the weeks leading up to the November 4th election, they were really adamant about sending out mailers and flyers and just kind of encouraging Somerville residents to not vote for the ballot question. Even after the election, they have posted on their website that they will continue to make sure that the ballot question is not realized as a full resolution.
And it's called Somerville United Against Discrimination, yeah. Which is so Orwellian, because the idea, of course, behind the ballot measure is to stop the discrimination and really elimination of Palestinians.
Exactly.
But somehow it seems as though the existence of Palestinians is seen as anti-Semitic, which is just, mm-hmm. you know, anyway. So this measure, this well-funded effort clearly failed because it's quite remarkable that it passed with 56%. Why did it fail? Why do you think Somerville residents didn't respond to this infusion of $200,000 into this, you know, sort of astroturfed organization?
Yeah, I think that what Somerville for Palestine organizers and the campaign did so well was engage the public and really educate them about the issue. So I think that despite how much money the ADL was able to throw into this oppositional campaign, Somerville for Palestine was able to do was kind of go against that well-funded opposition and really provide knowledge and provide information. And so they met people where they were at. They went to local farmers markets. They had a local running team that engaged with people who may not have really understood what was happening in Palestine and maybe didn't even understand how they were complicit in that. I think that what Somerville for Palestine also did really well was not just, you know, educating them on the issue, but making sure they understood how their taxpayer funds were going towards these companies that were supporting Israel. They had really creative activations. They were knocking on doors, canvassing, really building up their people power to make sure that people understood what was happening and also why this ADL-funded organization was so adamant in opposition. I think making sure people...
They didn't rely on the voters just educating themselves. They actively countered the ADL's efforts.
Yes. And I think they did a great job of making sure people also understood the broader BDS movement and that it was an international movement and that Somerville residents could tap in and really make a meaningful impact in that way.
What sort of links did they have with Palestinians, Palestinian Americans, people who have family in Gaza or the West Bank, or even just international links or links with folks outside Somerville? What was the kind of Palestinian-informed framing of this struggle?
Yeah. Well, many members of Somerville for Palestine are Palestinian American. Many have lived in Somerville their whole lives or majority of their lives and have really been waiting to see their community really rise up and support them. So there was links and connections within the actual body of the organization. But they also were really keen to listening to what folks in Palestine were saying that they wanted and needed. And a part of their drafting of the ballot question was keeping in mind those desires of Palestinians and their desire to have people link into and connect with the broader BDS movement. So that was directly coming from folks in Gaza, folks in Palestine.
So how did the city council respond? They seemed to respond favorably. I suppose they could have backtracked or they could have dragged their feet, but it seems as though they are taking steps to follow through and to do what voters asked them to do.
Yeah. Last week, November 26th, the city council passed a resolution to begin to study how to go about a divestment strategy. And so they have 1 year to draft and implement a divestment strategy. That passed 9-2. So there is a notable amount of support within the city council. And I think that the fact that the ballot question passed so overwhelmingly and received more votes than even the Somerville mayor-elect really touched city council members and really made them understand that this is what the people want.
If there are folks listening to this story, reading your article on PRISM, wondering how they can model or have a similar campaign inspired by what Somerville activists did, what are some things that you can suggest they do? It sounds as though the battle begins with information, finding out how many of your tax dollars or how far your tax dollars or your city's budget or cities' funds are invested in Israel? Is that the good starting point?
Absolutely. That following the money is the best place to start. Reading, studying the BDS list and understanding what these companies, who these companies are and how they are supportive of Israel is a huge start. And then lining that up against what you're seeing within your own city public records.
And then, of course, just committed activism. It seems like it can be such an insurmountable thing, but this battle that Somerville fought from passing the ceasefire resolution to having question three pass was only about 2 years. That's pretty remarkably short in terms of, you know, when we think of the speed at which change often happens.
Absolutely. And I think that another big tip or a strategy that people should keep in mind is anticipating that there's going to be opposition. And I know that in the case of Somerville, they had to get, I believe, 5,500 signatures, but their goal was 10,000 because they understood that those signatures would be disputed, right? So thinking about how can I circumvent potential opposition will be really, really useful and incorporating that into the campaign really early.
So Somerville is, I mentioned it was the first city, based on your reporting, that it was the first city in the United States to pass a ballot measure directing local authorities to divest. But it's not alone in such efforts nationwide. Tell me about, put it into the broader context of where there have been other local victories.
Yeah, just this year, two other counties within Massachusetts have passed divestment ordinances. Those came directly from the city council, so they weren't voted upon by residents. But, you know, that was a huge precedent setting for Somerville. And then other organizers in Michigan and other states have been really active in crafting and passing boycott legislation. And they have to work against anti-boycott legislation that has been really posing a lot of obstacles for these divestment campaigns.
What's next for Somerville as well? I imagine that the solidarity organization Somerville for Palestine is probably hoping to keep going in their activism to ensure the city council follows through properly, or do they have their sights set on, you know, the victory number three?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, as of when I was doing my reporting, the main goal was to get the city council to pass this ordinance. The ballot question itself was a non-binding ballot question. So that means that it didn't necessarily require the city council to act upon it until they voted for a resolution. So that was the next main hurdle, and they've already, you know, crossed it, which is amazing. I would imagine that a lot of Somerville for Palestine organizers are also working on helping other local organizers in other counties and other states pass similar legislation or to craft similar ballot questions too. So I think what's really exciting and interesting to learn over the course of the reporting was how deep in community these different organizations are and how much support they've been lending to one another and insights they've been giving one another based off of their past campaigns, whether they've been successful or not.
Tamar, where can people find out more about the work you do and read your writings, your journalism?
Thank you. Well, you can always follow Prism Reports. We are an amazing left woman-run organization, news organization with national coverage. You can find more of my reporting and my colleagues' reporting there. And you can also follow me on Instagram at Tamar Sarai.
And that's TamarSarai. Tamar, thank you so much for joining us. Good luck to you.
Thank you so much for having me.
My guest has been Tamar Sarai, a Philadelphia-based journalist who's currently a contributing writer at Prism and also a history PhD student at Temple University. And we've been talking about her reporting in Prism about Somerville, Massachusetts' victory to force its or to ask its city council to divest from Israel. I'm Sonali Kohatkar, host and executive producer of Rising Up with Sonali, an independently produced, subscriber-supported program nationally syndicated to radio stations, free speech TV, and podcast platforms. Thank you.
I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, host and executive producer of Rising Up with Sonali, an independently produced, subscriber-supported program nationally syndicated to radio stations, free speech TV, and podcast platforms. Our interviews are available to subscribers at risingupwithsonali.com. Right-wing ideas and stories infuse our culture every day, powered by the endless resources of billionaires and other moneyed elites. Those stories shape our culture and our policies. Now, a new anthology of strategies aims to help progressive, people-centered narratives take hold. Stories that can reshape our world to center collective care and equity. It's called Liberation Stories, Building Narrative Power for 21st Century Social Movements. Its co-editors join me. Chanel Matthews is the founder of the Radical Communicators Network and former communications director for the Movement for Black Lives. She's currently a distinguished lecturer at City College CUNY in New York. Marzena Zdzukowska is a queer, non-binary Polish immigrant and co-founder of the immigrant rights group POMOK, a longtime strategist and organizer. They've led narrative work for major movements across the US, UK, and Europe. Welcome to the program, Chanel and Marzena.
Thank you so much for having us.
Let me start by asking you how you have organized this book, which I'm, by the way, super excited about in terms of what it offers our movements, something that I think was so desperately needed. You've organized the book into these various categories of topics, of causes, and you start with, I guess, the big internationalist questions of imperialism, and then you move into the more national, the more maybe micro issues or smaller issues. Begin by telling me how and why you organized the book in this way.
Yeah, I can kick us off. So first off, the book covers 24 years of movement history, and that's specifically contemporary movement history. So, you know, we started with this big question of imperialism and the war on terror because, you know, we can't talk about what is happening in the United States and globally without understanding how the war on terror and its narrative infrastructures and the tentacles that extend across the globe function. We can see that right now with everything that is happening in Iran and with the genocide of Gaza. So we start off in the 2000s, and then the book goes on. Actually, the last chapter that we commissioned was in the summer of 2024. So really what we end with is kind of the COVID-19 pandemic and the activism around that, and also the movement for Palestinian liberation in opposition to the ongoing genocide in Gaza. Now, the book also goes back further in history, right? So we understand that today's movements are very much shaped by the lineage that we have been a part of. So, you know, the book goes as far back as referencing, you know, the 19th century and the movement for reparations and how it's developed today. To kind of look at the structure maybe more broadly, we really wanted it to reflect the ethos of how social movements function in the first place. You know, the story that is kind of in people's popular imagination oftentimes is like the hero narrative, you know, that social movements function because there's, you know, a single leader or a couple of leaders at the helm, and those are the people who are most recognized. But what Chanel and I know, and all of the authors who are featured in the anthology, and there are 62 of them, is that movements are made up of everyday people, which is why they are so successful in challenging power. It's because they're able to rely on the relationships we build with one another. And that's very much the ethos that we have centered in the book, which is why it's, you know, not just a book on narrative power authored by me and Chanel, but it's one that features so many cultural workers, artists, organizers, narrative practitioners, and the people who really have often been behind the scenes working tirelessly to make sure that our social movements can not just build power, but shift what is considered normal, you know, shift the norms and rules of society. So yeah, so you'll see that in how the book is structured and the voices that are featured.
And the Radical Communicators Network is listed as a co-author. And maybe Chanel, you can tell me a little bit about Radical Communicators Network or RADCOMS, and how it's story, if you will, is intertwined with the work that you've presented in this book.
Yeah, it's a really good question. It's probably helpful to give a little background to how Mars and I started working together in relationship to how RADCOMS evolved. We were both communications workers in the 2010s who were working at organizations who were building power for big, bold ideas. I was the director of communications for the Black Lives Matter Global Network and the Movement for Black Lives, and Marjana was the media director for the National Domestic Workers Alliance. And we had a comrade, Alicia Garza, in common, who was working in both organizations. So we had to be in touch to organize some of the press that she was doing. At the same time, we were grappling with major questions of seismic political shifts in the United States. We had just come off of the Occupy movement, which was a global reckoning around capital and capitalism and the exploitation of everyday people and the greed of the capitalist class and the way that that impacted global economies and everyday people, specifically pointing to the largest theft of Black wealth since slavery. And that brought conversations to the fore around socialism that we hadn't heard in my lifetime. So what allowed people like Bernie Sanders and AOC to propel to prominence was this discourse around the 99% versus the 1% that society was discussing, and that everyday people were giving their input on how they wanted their economic systems and their governance systems to be shaped. At the same time, we saw the rise of the Black Lives Matter movement. While we were contending with this kind of dominant narrative of a post-racial society because we had a Black president, we were also seeing a rise in state-sanctioned violence against Black people in the form of police violence, medical neglect, and so on. At the same time, we saw the Me Too movement come to the fore, where we had a global reckoning around sexual violence, and also an intervention by Black women leaders to ensure that the solutions that were posited around this were not just going to solve the problems of the white, wealthy actresses who were using their platforms to talk about these ideas, but would also solve the problems of little Black girls who were often ignored or exploited. So we are dealing with these like very seismic shifts in a progressive era, which is a time characterized by, you know, advancing sometimes radical rhetoric, often progressive rhetoric, progressive organizing strategies. And as communications workers, we knew that while communications is often considered ornamental to social movements, it's actually foundational to every single discipline inside of social movements. If you think about the legal discipline, you know, that's a story about what laws should be passed, which ones should be repealed or amended. Fundraising strategies for social movements require a story about why things should be paid for and who should be paying for them. Even organizers, you know, often organizers and communications workers are bifurcated or pit against each other, but organizers use a rap, which is a persuasive message to get people to get it, to get buy into our movements. And so the Radical Communicators Network was born in 2016 as a place for communications workers to be organized, to sharpen each other, to talk about our ideological differences, to understand how to strengthen our movements through rhetorical strategies. We were founded after Trump was elected the first time in many ways to galvanize ourselves to ensure that he didn't get elected again. But we ended up being so much more than just a network. We have grown together, learned together. You know, and selfishly, when I made the call for RADCOMS the first time in 2016, I really needed a place where I could say, hey, everybody, I don't know exactly what I'm doing because I've never lived in these conditions before. Can we talk about what we want to do together? And we've grown over the last 10 years to do a lot of different political projects together. And I would argue that the anthology is one of our most important projects. And the reason why RADCOMS is listed as an author, or as an editor rather, is because we have so many people in the book who are members of our network. And we're still growing. You know, we've just released a curriculum called Rad School, which uses the book as a text to guide people through a 12-week seminar on building narrative power. And just to be clear, narrative power is, you know, a type of power that shapes the norms and rules by which our societies live. It's about who gets to tell stories in a society and who tells them and how they're interpreted, and really shaping beliefs and worldviews through the power of storytelling, but it's also about narrative infrastructure. So as we see the techno-feudalist class rise and start to reshape society in their in the way that they want to, we have to also be exploiting the contemporary means of communications. That means TikTok, Instagram, social media platforms, podcast, Discord, to be able to ensure that our revolutionary counter stories and counter narratives are just as prevalent as those dominant narratives.
Now, I'm so glad you brought up that, essentially narratives is about more than narrative power is about more than storytelling, right? That bigger infrastructure and all of the things that are needed to put into place. And it's so important because it shapes our culture. And there are two issues that keep coming up in the last year especially, and maybe in the last few months most, that I'd love for one or both of you to take on as examples of how we need to move forward on building narrative power. One is the struggle for Palestinian liberation, and the other is immigrant rights. Both of these issues are strife with right-wing talking points. The former on Palestine, of course, being that any criticism of Palestine of Israel is akin to anti-Semitism, which is a huge thing people have to deal with in the movement. And the other on immigration is that if you're an undocumented immigrant, you're automatically a criminal simply by virtue of not having papers. So let's start with Palestine. How important is narrative work on Palestine, and how does one break out of that prison of accusations of anti-Semitism every time Israel is criticized?
So in Liberation Stories, we had an incredible chapter that was written by Nora Ericott and Tanya Kehlani, who are, activists, academics, thinkers, and media strategists who have been, working in service to Palestine liberation for a very long time. And they had written a very different chapter. Actually, it was one of the first chapters that had been submitted in the anthology, I think back in like 2021. But the reality is that working on an anthology project like this is a long one, right? And so the socio-political and economic conditions are constantly shifting. And when October 7th happened and the genocide against Palestinians in Gaza started ramping up, we had a very real and sober conversation with Tanya and Nora about the fact that many of the insights and takeaways, many of the analyses around the success of the Palestinian liberation movement, the way that it had been able to shift media discourse, were no longer relevant at a time when the scale of destruction and death felt almost unprecedented. And so we came back to the table with Tanya and Nora and decided instead that it would be, they had kindly agreed to still participate and to do an incredibly powerful interview that you can read almost word for word in Liberation Stories. And both of them are strategists and constantly analyzing how the media functions. So I think exactly what you were saying, Sonali, the consistent use of passive voice to describe the deaths of and the killings of Palestinians compared to the treatment of Israelis who were killed on October 7th, the way Palestinian spokespeople and experts and their expertise is consistently undermined through the asking of, but what about Hamas, right? Won't you first condemn Hamas? And the broader reality of how few Palestinian journalists, editors, and producers are actually embedded in our media infrastructure and are actively excluded due to a white supremacist system that prioritizes certain voices over others. So Tanya and Nora kind of give, a bit of that overview in the interview that they share. And one of the things that they hit home is as a first step, how important it is for us, even as everyday people, to understand how these systems of oppression function in the first place. So in order for us to be able to discern fact from fiction, in order for us to be able to understand how a skewed headline in a news article or, an opening lead in a news piece functions, like, we need to have the tools of media literacy to be able to call these things out. So that's kind of the baseline. I think the second one, which is very much echoed in our in the chapter on the War on Terror written by Dr. Maha Hilal and Curry Peterson, is that it's the centering of voices that are closest to the oppression. Now, it feels almost, it should go without saying that we need to be asserting the humanity of the people who are closest to the problem, closest to the oppression and the marginalization. And it's really, it speaks to the time of really fascism and its resurgence that we're in, that we're having to go back to the basics and say, the people that you choose to prioritize as the spokespeople, how their voices are framed, that first and foremost, we need to be able to assert that humanity, which I think, comes out very, very clearly in Tanya Nora's piece as well. And the same as in the War on Terror chapter. And the last thing I think I'll mention, and I'll pass it over to Chanel, is context. And I reflect on this kind of more broadly of how the media apparatus functions in moments of crisis. And this is something that, Naomi Klein has talked about for a very long time with respect to how disaster capitalism functions, of how, authoritarian and right-wing governments are able to take advantage of these moments by decontextualizing what we are witnessing. So, how many media outlets after October 7th were able to restart the timeline to say, actually, everything that is happening right now started on this specific date, when in reality, the Nakba was in 1948. So for us, as not just communication strategists, but as everyday people, the onus is on us that once we have those tools of media literacy, that we are constantly bringing the broader systemic context into play, because fascism thrives on decontextualization. It thrives on dehumanization. So bringing in those grassroots voices, centering the people who are closest to the problem, and bringing in the wider context, I think are all crucial pieces to keep in mind.
Right.
Yeah, I would love to add, that was beautiful, Mars. I would love to just add some different elements to this. If we think about the way that oppositional forces use narrative, there is typically a playbook. We've seen this in post-Reconstruction America, where Black political power was rising, that they used a kind of law and order, similar to what we're seeing today, narrative to quell that Black political power and to subjugate Black people even further. When you're talking about Palestine, there are a few ways in which nuance is weaponized in order to benefit the opposition. First is selective framing. So this is where they deliberately emphasize or de-emphasize certain aspects of a multifaceted issue. So this is kind of what Mars was talking about in terms of the context. They're trying to manipulate people's perceptions, like selectively presenting facts or using half-truths to shape a different narrative that serves a particular political agenda. So this includes selectively choosing data or stats or examples that support particular viewpoints. And one example of this is the way in which the New York Times has consistently mentioned Israeli deaths more often than Palestinian deaths. And Mona Chalabi, who is a statistician for The Guardian, talks about this quite a lot. She argues that their coverage of Israeli deaths is actually increasing as more Palestinians die. So even though Israeli deaths have plateaued and Palestinian deaths have skyrocketed, Israeli deaths have been mentioned the most. Another way that nuance is weaponized in this particular instance, and also with the War on Terror, is the divide and conquer approach, where they exploit differences within oppressed groups to sow discord. So we'll all remember the kind of shadow social media campaigns that were trying to pit Palestinians and Black people against each other. And this is the goal here is to weaken collective action or solidarity and to really pit subgroups against each other to prevent us from uniting against a common adversary. A third way is scapegoating. We're seeing this happen a lot with the uprisings in LA around the ICE raids and the kidnapping of people from their communities. And this happens when oppressors blame oppressed groups or individuals for complex societal issues or problems. And this really oversimplifies the causes and diverts attention from underlying structural or systemic factors. This playbook is it's well-worn. They've used it for hundreds of years. But it's important for us to remember that we can identify these different elements. Just a fourth really quickly is a false equivalency. And so this is drawing false parallels between two disparate actions to create the illusion of moral equivalence or equivalent wrongdoing. So the Israeli government and its allies are using this to deflect criticism and normalize genocidal behavior. We have to be mindful of when these are happening and understand how to counter them with our own stories. We don't want to spend too much time talking about what the opposition is doing, but we do need to delegitimize their arguments and then also offer people an alternative reality for what's happening. And if we can do this, then we can meaningfully build narrative power for the communities that we're working on behalf of.
And you interview in your book Rinku Sen and Roberto Lovato, two people I know very well and respect so much. I was so happy to see this conversation around a historical lesson that was actually an example of success where they worked on this campaign to drop the I word. Now, of course, the right keeps reviving the word illegal, a dehumanizing term to refer to undocumented people. But there was there is an example of the success that can be had when there's a strategic campaign to pressure mainstream, at least media, to start referring to immigrant people as human beings rather than as this dehumanizing term, illegals. And so I'm wondering if you can point to, there's so much to talk about, but we have limited time. I'm wondering if you can point to some ways in which, some examples of where, like the Drop the I Word campaign, narrative power had enjoyed some success, that there was a model that worked well, that can inspire others, and also show how important it is to build narrative power.
Yeah, I can kick us off here and hand it off to Mars. It's challenging being a leftist because what is considered success is subjective for a lot of us, and also our wins can feel few and far between. But as people who are trying to advance a revolutionary politic, we have to understand narrative power successes as even putting people in a position to consider that what they believe is right, it could be wrong, right? So it's not always necessarily changing people's minds right away or their hearts or their worldview, because that's very hard to do. But it is about seeding doubt that what is the status quo is correct. And it's also about expanding the possibilities of what people believe is right. And it, and also expanding the possibilities of what people believe they should be fighting for. Because narrative power alone will not get us to our aims. We need structural power as well. And I think this is really reflective in the global moral reckoning we have around Palestine. Most people agree that what is happening to the Palestinians is morally wrong. And yet we do not have the structural power to be able to stop the deaths in Palestine. And so that is why it's so important for us to organize and base build. But in my chapter on the Movement for Black Lives and the Black Radical Tradition, which I co-wrote with Miski Noor from The Forge and former Black Visions co-director, it looks at the power of the Defund the Police campaign. And while a lot of people will look at this campaign and say it wasn't a success, I think that is because they don't quite understand how social movements work. The social movement left's job is, again, to expand the possibilities of expand what is possible in people's imagination. And when the Movement for Black Lives and Black Lives Matter was organizing in the 2010s, we were trying to help people understand the importance of state-sanctioned violence and ending it. And when George Floyd was murdered and Breonna Taylor was murdered, of course, we saw a national and global uprising against police violence. But what we also saw happening in the background was that people were positing reforms that we had already determined did not work. For example, in the early 2010s, body cameras were implemented as a, you know, what people thought were going to be a very quick fix to a long storied systemic problem. And now we know that body cameras do not work because it's not necessarily about what people see on the camera. It's how they understand the body, and particularly the Black body, that is being impacted or harmed, and how they, and the narrative and stories and stereotypes that have been laid over that body, so that Black people, so people believe often that Black people are inherently criminal. And if you believe that Black people are inherently criminal, then it doesn't actually matter what the police officer is doing to you. In some ways, people justify that because of what they believe about you. So the goal for the Defund the Police campaign was to help people understand that we needed to limit the scope, size, and budget of police departments. Now, what's important to mention here is that this campaign didn't come out of nowhere. This was a strategic intervention made by left organizers who wanted to create a response and to give people an opportunity to debate what the role of police should be in U.S. society. So when we think about how to understand narrative power and its successes, there is a chapter by Dorian Warren and Catherine Ollenberger on the Occupy movement, and they offer four functions of narrative power that I think are helpful to list here. So the first function is agenda setting. This, it means that the issue that you want to be discussed is actually on the agenda and up for political discussion and in public discourse. Now, we might take this for granted because we have access to social media, but to make something widely discussed by the public is actually not very easy. You can think of people who try to make things go viral all the time, right? And as communications workers, we get these requests all the time to make this go viral. But virality really is about tapping into what is in pop culture and in everyday people's lives. And so when we said defund the police, this was an incendiary derivative of a frame that we had been using for decades, which was divest, invest. Divest from harmful systems and invest in communities. Now, divest, invest doesn't have the same emotional salience as defund the police. And that's why it's important to understand how movement rhetoric functions in particular political cycles. We wanted to incite people to have a discussion, and a discussion was had. Defund the police stayed in the public discourse for 3 years. We had people telling us that we were being divisive and unstrategic, when in fact what we did was created a radical flank for a more moderate message to be well received. And that more moderate message was something like, you know, reimagining public safety. But we did put it on the agenda. The president, the former president, the incoming president, they were all talking about it. Now, they weren't happy about it, and the progressive class certainly wasn't happy about it, but we found that it was incredibly helpful to get people discussing the kind of minutia of what it meant to move money from police departments to mental health, to domestic violence prevention, to gang prevention. And so these were the discussions that were being had on mainstream media. And for the first time in my lifetime, I saw abolitionist arguments in the mainstream. The second function of narrative power that Dorian and Catherine offer is salience. So what does it mean to make an idea resonant for everyday people? What does it mean to have it so that they understand it, that they say, yes, this is something that I get and that feels clear to me? Now, initially, the defund the police frame was really inciting people, but then we started hearing media makers describe what we meant. Oh, they're not talking about defunding the police. I mean, we were. They're talking about moving money from police to X, Y, and Z. We were talking about both. And just to be fair, there was a more abolitionist group who was saying they wanted to abolish the police. So that was that. And then finally, the last two are around persistence and changing people's worldview. So how do you keep an idea on the agenda over time? You have to continue to do storytelling. You have to continue to delegitimize the arguments that are being made against that idea. We know we did that because the Republicans spent $33 million in attack ads in the 2022 midterms. That were trying to connect Democrats to the defund the police movement. But finally, and probably the hardest element of narrative power, is changing people's worldviews. And that is getting people to think differently about the ideas that you're positing. We do know that we were able to seed a little bit of doubt in people's minds, because in 2021, when all those young, those babies and those teachers were killed in that Uvalde school shooting, the police were outside the doors, and we watched as public discourse on social media started to question what the role was of police if they were not going to stop those. So again, it's putting things on the agenda, making it salient and resonant to people, keeping it on the agenda, and then actually changing people's worldviews.
And what your answer really has emphasized, that this is long-term work. It's not putting the perfect press release together. Narrative power is a long-term agenda, And you're right, it's so hard for so many of us to see the successes because we get overwhelmed. And those of us who are doing the work or in these communication spaces may have the longer arc and may see those successes more clearly. And so I'm wondering if we can wrap up our discussion just talking about the way forward. Do you see, for example, enough resources being put toward narrative power building? I mentioned at the beginning of this conversation that the right is so well resourced because they have the vast, endless resources of billionaires. And it feels like philanthropists who might share the values of progressives don't put enough of their resources towards and their money towards the storytelling aspect of movements. I may be wrong. Maybe it's changing. You know, how does this work get supported and resourced?
Yeah, it's a great question, Sonali. I think the first thing that we have to say and open this up by saying that, you know, the revolution won't be funded, harkening back to the Insight anthology that came before us, meaning that we can't be, our revolutionary and radical movements can't be solely dependent on philanthropic dollars, which themselves have roots in industrial capitalism that has created a lot of the problems that we see today. So, you know, I think many of the authors in the book, and I think, you know, many of the movements that we work across take a bit of a harm reduction approach, right? We recognize that this is where we are right now, and we need to be using every single tool at our disposal in order to move the dial away from fascism and towards the kind of liberation that we'd like to see in society. And at the same time, we can't stay there, right? We have to be able to have in mind a more revolutionary and liberatory goals than a lot of the reforms that, for example, you know, many groups tried to pass through Congress actually are. So I would say a couple of things maybe around, you know, how this work is being resourced. I think first and foremost, I think we've seen some really interesting models over the years, I think especially in terms of supporting grassroots political campaigns that are actually funded by the people, where it is the people who have relationships with one another, who want to see a particular impact in a community. I'm thinking of Zoran Mamdani's campaign. I mean, today is June 24th, so New York City, I know, is going out to vote in the mayoral elections. But
and his narrative, his campaign's narrative work has been remarkable and remarkably successful.
Exactly. And it's felt, and this is something that we try to hit home in the book, is that narrative power building succeeds when a lot of people feel a sense of ownership over it. So narrative power isn't something that's cooked up in a laboratory. It's something that is that is created and co-created by the people who are using it every single day, right? The organizers who are building it in their communities. And I think resourcing this work has to function the exact same way. So, you know, while we do need to be kind of working with the more values aligned foundations right now, if we are to even have any kind of counterbalance to the massive machinery that we are up against, the machinery that's been built for decades, if not centuries, that is, you know, ownership of media apparatus. It is the ownership of the means of production, right? The banks, the financial institutions. So I think, you know, we do have to find the values aligned partners, but we also have to be looking for alternatives. And I think this has come about in a lot of successful political campaigns. I also think, and this is something that I know, Chanel, you had alluded to, but the cooperatives movement as well. So what does it look like for our social movements to feel more equitable, and for us to look at models from, you know, more socialist and internationalist movements that have actually existed for a very long time, and ones that have functioned outside of the nonprofit industrial complex. And I also think of we don't have a chapter from them in the book, but, you know, I think about the work that had been done for so many years by the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, right? And how resistant the movement had been, you know, fighting for workers' rights, having some pretty powerful and antagonistic campaigns to try and bring, for example, you know, the Wendy's of the world, the Taco Bell's of the world, to the bargaining table so that they're actually paying, you know, more per pound of tomatoes that they were, that could actually fund much better wages for people. But the Coalition of Immokalee Workers refused to put spokespeople out, like specific faces and heroes of movements, because what they kept saying is that our movements are made up of everyday people. We need to protect each other, and we need to ensure that we don't feed into one of us getting elevated above all else and kind of continuing to feed into the nonprofit industrial complex. And that poses a lot of challenges for resourcing, right? Because a lot of foundations, and we do have a chapter on philanthropy in the book, but a lot of foundations kind of have this expectation of, you know, what is their point of contact? You know, whose work are they actually funding? They want to see the person. And the truth is, that's not how movements function. So I think if, you know, For all the people working in philanthropy out there, you know, if you want to be resourcing movements, I think it requires understanding how, you know, how they function. And the chapter that we have written by Mandy Van Devin and Zainab Muhammad, both are organizers, activists who, you know, have put in the work within social justice organizations, but have also worked very much to try and organize in and around and within philanthropy, have some really powerful insights in there for what foundations could do if they want to resource this work.
Sonali, can I add one note?
Yeah.
I agree so much with everything that Marjana said. We are in an ideological contest for the future, and the philanthropic institutions are not keeping up. But I think that that's how they were designed in many ways, that philanthropy was has created these rules and norms that are meant to curb the most radical impulses of social movements. Social movements existed long before philanthropic institutions did. And as Mar said, in many ways, we are working to solve the problems that they created. And they're giving us resources to do that, but it has to be an agenda driven by them. What I would say is, like, there are some people who are trying in responsive philanthropy and radical philanthropy to do things differently. But in many ways, the largest philanthropic institutions are watching us drown as they hold the kind of life rafts above their head. And we are asking them to invest more into not just narrative power building, but base building, policy advocacy, to the grassroots organizations who are working with everyday people to build local power, and also to invest in the organizations who are also doing the legal work, the broader storytelling work. And in our field, that means, you know, the Opportunity Agenda and the Center for Story-Based Strategy and Reframe and RADCOMS. And we're all eager for more resources, but most importantly, we're eager to have autonomous agendas that allow us to build real liberatory power and to actually contest for ideological power in this reactionary era.
Right. Well, I want to thank both of you so much for joining me today. I'm very excited about this book and hope it does very well and it gets into lots of people's hands. Thank you both so much.
Thank you, Sonali.
Thank you, Sonali.
My guests have been Chanel Matthews, founder of the Radical Communicators Network, former communications director for the Movement for Black Lives, currently a distinguished lecturer at City College CUNY in New York, and Marjana Żukowska, a queer non-binary Polish immigrant and co-founder of the immigrant rights groups Promoc, a longtime strategist and organizer. They've led narrative work for major movements across the US, UK, and Europe, and they are the co-editors, along with the Radical Communicators Network, of the book Liberation Stories, which we've just been discussing. The subtitle is Building Narrative Power for 21st Century Social Movements. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, host and executive producer of Rising Up with Sonali, an independently produced, subscriber-supported program nationally syndicated to radio stations, free speech TV, and podcast platforms. We'll be right back.
Hey family, if you haven't already, I invite you to tune in to one of KPFK's strongest traditions, our Spanish language slate, airing Monday through Thursday, 8 p.m. to midnight. A rich mix of public affairs, environmental justice, immigration news, deep dives into Latin America, and of course, music that moves the soul. It's community radio at its finest, an español for la comunidad. So tell a friend, spread the word, and listen in Monday through Thursday, 8 p.m. to midnight, right here on KPFK 90.7 FM and kpfk.org. Familia, les tengo una